The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Clare for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Clare.
And I'm Stan Clare, and I have the pleasure tonight of having with me Natalie Solomon, our producer. Well, she was a volunteer, or she was supposed to be a volunteer, but she volunteered herself. And, she's an ardent feminist. Have to say that up front. Also have, DJ Flo, who's busy with the blinking lights. And, we have the real privilege and pleasure of having Luke Albinski, a Polish Catholic based in Johannesburg, co-founder of Vantage Capital's mezzanine business, which offers long-term growth capital to mid-sized businesses across Africa. His interest in Holocaust and genocide work springs from his personal history as well as from his on-the-ground involvement with a non-profit during the Bosnian conflict. So just to open the discussion, so clearly you're a Polish Catholic, you're a Catholic, but somewhere along the line you discovered that you had some Jewish roots, and hence we invited you on to come and tell us about this, because today genealogy has become a big thing. And not only that, we found that as we delve deep and deep into this, everybody's got a story, and some are bad and some are good, and some have good outcomes and some have bad outcomes, but you have a good outcome. You're here to tell the tale, and you have a history of finding your Jewish root, but still remaining Catholic. I just want to say that when I was in the army in South Africa, we used to be called Holy Romans and Philistines. So that was the, the Catholics and the Jews. We used to be separated from the others when it came to church and shul and whatever. So Luke, give us some background. Somewhere along the line, you grew up in Johannesburg, you thought you were Catholic, and suddenly one day, hello, I'm actually have Jewish roots. Or is that how it happened?
Yes. So my parents kept it a big secret. The person that I have to blame or to thank for seriously complicating my life was in fact my cousin. So she was the daughter of Stan Rowinski, who is my mom's youngest brother. And we met up in Europe when I was in my early 20s. And one night she told me, listen, I've got some interesting information about your family background that you're probably unaware of. But your grandmother was Jewish, and she was gassed in Treblinka.
Wow.
And so that's how it all started, and it's been quite a journey since then. I've spent many thousands of rands on therapy, but I think it's enriched me nonetheless.
Sure.
By the way, Luke is the first person on the show that's come here in a suit. Well, that's impressive.
So how did you feel when you first started these investigations, as you mentioned, launching you into a therapy career? Did you feel, how did it leave you?
Well, I mean, obviously, there was the challenge of engaging my parents on the subject. And, for many, many years, it had been a taboo subject with my parents. You know, I don't think they had spoken much about it amongst themselves, let alone mentioning it to the kids.
There must have been some sort of fear factor, because clearly you didn't want to admit it when you were in Poland. If you were, but coming to South Africa, I mean, why wouldn't they admit it? Or was it just something that they had so long kept the secret? And
you know, I think the primary motivation was driven, I think, more by my dad than my mom. And it was driven by a desire not to complicate his kids' lives, to give them one anchored identity not to make things too complicated and too messy. I think that was the primary motivation.
They didn't believe wanted you to have a choice.
They didn't want me to, I guess, get confused about what is my religious affiliation? What is my background? They didn't want to expose me necessarily to just the tragic depths of what they had been through.
So they had left Poland presumably during the Holocaust, during the war.
No, not at all. So what happened was that, my mom and her three brothers, were smuggled out of the Warsaw ghetto in terrible condition. I mean, they were so ill. They were really starved, had boils all over their bodies, had a kidney inflammation, lung inflammations, really in a terrible physical condition.
So that was around, 1939?
No. This was in 1942.
Okay.
This was just before the great, what's called the Große Nation, which was when about 250,000 Jews, were sent from the Warsaw Ghetto to their death in Treblinka. Yes. And when it became clear that this was the Nazis' intention, Polish Catholic doctors that knew my grandmother, because my grandmother was a specialist doctor, organized for her children to leave the ghetto, to stay with Polish Catholic families who risked their lives to keep the kids
Yes, safe. Amazing.
And then were placed in an orphanage with, 50 plus, Polish Catholic orphans. And again, the orphanage, the staff of the orphanage again risked their lives to hide these Jewish kids.
Now your parents knew each other at that point?
No. So my mom graduated from the orphanage, went to university. She went to the Polish Technical University called the Warsaw Polytechnic. And she was studying chemical engineering. My dad was, studying land surveying. There's an interesting story, by the way, on that score because my dad, when he was in his final year of schooling, he went to a teacher that he loved very much at school, and he said, "Look, I really love writing." My dad was a writer, and I'd like to become a journalist. And this teacher said to him, "Listen, if you become a journalist in the current environment in Poland, you're going to be lying every day of your life. So I would urge you not to become a journalist." And so my dad decided to, he still went and did some courses in Polish literature and film and so on, but he became a land surveyor. And so they met at the Warsaw Polytechnic, in the 50s, as young students. And, then in order to get married, my grandmother, so my father's mother, on the Catholic side of the family, had to go and find fraudulent birth certificates and baptism certificates and so on, so that they could actually get married, because my mom had essentially a false identity.
Right.
And then they got married in...
So your father was Catholic?
My father was Catholic.
Your mother was Jewish. Which actually makes you Jewish.
Yes.
Sorry to tell you.
No. don't say sorry. I'm very happy.
Something that you spoke about to us, which is so important, was looking at how members of your father's family were also involved in the resistance from a different perspective, but also suffered greatly.
Yes. Well, you know, that's, I was mentioning it to you before the radio interview, this, what you've got to guard against is this kind of egoism of suffering.
Yes.
So, you know, and I have the unique privilege in a way of having tragedy on both sides of this great divide, the Polish Catholic versus the Polish Jewish divide. So,
right.
My grandfather on the Polish Catholic side, so my dad's father, he was walking home one day from his vegetable patch in 1944. The Warsaw Uprising was underway, which was the largest armed uprising in occupied Europe, involving more than 20,000, actually more than 40,000, armed fighters. And, the SS decided to round up several thousand men in his suburb as a preemptive measure, because they were worried that maybe this suburb, which was called Włochy, which was a little outside Warsaw Central, might join, the uprising. And my grandfather was one of those several thousand men that were rounded up by the SS. My dad still remembers how he ran along the lines to give my grandfather a penknife. And then they were kind of marched off, put on trains, and sent to Auschwitz. So my grandfather spent some time in Auschwitz, prisoner number 90748, and then he was transferred to Buchenwald concentration camp towards the end of the war, and he died in Buchenwald on the 28th of December 1944. So that's and you know, that was not uncommon. There were many millions of Polish Catholics that were murdered by the Nazis too.
Absolutely. I mean, there are many other gypsies and all sorts of other
homosexuals.
Yes, everybody. So, you know, it was across the board. I mean, Jews, of course, we feel we have the right of ownership, but you know, if you go to the Holocaust Center, that they, or Holocaust centers around the world, and you look at the history, I mean, it's obviously it's a much wider situation.
I guess so, an atrocity against mankind,
yeah,
really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the other part of the story was my great uncle Mieczysław, who joined the resistance. So he was actually fighting the Nazis in the streets of Warsaw in August, September 1944. He fought the Nazis in the Wola district, which was notorious for large-scale civilian massacres committed by the Nazis. They murdered something like 40,000 people in the Wola district. And then he ended up being pushed back into kind of the central district of Warsaw and eventually was taken as a prisoner of war. Found himself in Germany in a prisoner of war camp and was liberated by the Americans. And what was tragic about his story was that he never went back to Poland. He stayed in Germany and he lived out his life on a U.S. Army base in Germany. And the reason for that was because the underground army, so the people that were fighting the Nazis, were treated with tremendous suspicion by the communists. Because they were organized, they represented a certain elite of the society. And so many, underground army members, AK members, were tracked down after the war. Some of them were murdered, others imprisoned for many years. And so, my great uncle felt fearful to go back to communist Poland after the war.
So when did he pass away?
1981.
Oh, so he spent quite a lot of time there.
No, he spent a long time in Germany, yeah. So.
And then your parents, where did they meet in this?
So they met in Warsaw, at the Warsaw Polytechnic. They got married in Poland. And then, they, you know, through a
this
bit
was
of,
after the war already.
Yes, this was 1959 they got married. And then, through some bribery and corruption, they managed to get an exit visa and leave Poland on a vacation, which lasted about 30 years.
Because not only did they live through the Nazi regime, they also had to live through communist
through communist Poland, which was a terrible, particularly in the Stalinist years, was a terrible place.
So where did their travels take them? Because so they ended up in South Africa.
So they went first to Paris, where my mom remembers doing odd jobs, painting people's apartments to make a little bit of money as political refugees. And then they went to Switzerland, and they both got good jobs in Switzerland. My mom tells this funny story how she interviewed at ABB, a big Swiss company. Yes. And they said to her, look, we need a few days to check your qualifications because Warsaw Polytechnic, you know, we don't know what that's worth. We need to check it out. And so they went away and they came back 3 days later and told my mom that the Warsaw Polytechnic was of the same standard as the Zurich Polytechnic.
Wow.
And that she could get a job on Swiss pay, you know, immediately. So they stayed in Switzerland for a good few years. I was born there. And then my dad decided to take a contract to go and do land surveying work in the newly independent country of Botswana. Botswana had just become independent. I think it became independent in 67. And 69, they decided they needed maps of the country, and to create proper maps, they needed a land surveyor to go out there and put trigonometric beacons up on the top of various hills and measure various spaces. And so my dad spent a couple of years there. I was born in Switzerland, came out when I was a little baby to Botswana with my mom, and then they ended up in South Africa.
Sure.
So you came here into South Africa. Your cousin told you that you had a Jewish connection, and what happened then?
Well, then I started to, you know, I started to chat to my mom and her brothers, and my cousins and my dad, and you know, some people were much more open than others about it.
What was your mother like?
I think with my mom, it took time. It took time. You know, there's also a lot of trauma, a lot of trauma being a child in the ghetto.
Reliving it all,
reliving the loss of her mom, who also had a chance to be saved, who also had a chance to take what was called the ticket of life, that had been organized for her by these wonderful Polish Catholic doctors that belonged to an organization called Zygota. Zygota was called the Council for the Aid of Jews, and it was set up as part of the underground army structures. So it was an official organization. It wasn't just a social movement of some kind. It was actually an official organization, part of the underground structures that was set up to help Jews. So they produced something like 50,000 papers, fraudulent papers, to try and help Jews. And this doctor that saved my mom and her brothers and wanted to save my grandmother, he actually used to perform operations to reverse circumcisions so that Jewish males could survive in Aryan Warsaw. So this was quite a remarkable story.
Suddenly got a terrible pain somewhere.
So your grandmother.
So my grandmother, she had the opportunity to also leave the ghetto and go into hiding on the Aryan side. And in the end, she decided voluntarily to give up twice that opportunity and to go to her death with her patients to Treblinka.
But she had forced your grandfather to leave.
So my grandfather was a very wealthy, high-profile Jewish industrialist in pre-war Poland. He and his brother owned the Chrysler dealership for the whole of Poland. They also had a very innovative chemicals factory that was producing synthetic tire technology, which was of great interest to the Americans. That actually resulted in my great uncle surviving the Holocaust because he was smuggled out of Poland by British intelligence because of this knowledge that he had about synthetic rubber production. So they were amongst the richest people in Poland at the time. I mean, they had a joint venture with the Polish Ministry of Defense to produce various military equipment, which is also interesting in and of itself, because people like to portray this great opposition between the Jews and the Polish Catholics. But here you had Jewish industrialists in working very closely with the Poles to try and develop the defense capability ahead of this Nazi onslaught. So when he, when war broke out, my grandmother, you know, even without any prior knowledge of the Shoah and of what was going to happen, it was pretty obvious that the first person the Nazis were going to arrest would have been my Jewish grandfather. So he attempted to leave Poland on the eastern side, going to Romania. But of course, on the 17th of September, 1939, the Soviets invaded Poland on the east. And so he was caught by the Soviets. And there he was quite lucky, because he could have been sent off to Siberia, as many Jews did end up in Siberia.
Right.
But because of his engineering skills, he ended up running a big factory in Rostov, then in the Ural, behind the Ural Mountains when the Nazis invaded. And then at the end of the Second World War, again, because of his technical skills, because he was a highly trained engineer, he was tasked with disassembling German factories in the Soviet zone and shipping all the equipment back to the Soviet Union. And so I have pictures of him in a Soviet Army officer's uniform with the rank of a major in Berlin in May 1945. It's quite extraordinary.
And he went from such opulence to a later stage when he lived in circumstances that were incredibly dire.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was really this little village in the middle of nowhere. No hot water, no running toilet in the house, you know, just really incredibly basic life.
And never got back to
your
grandmother.
Well, my grandmother was dead at the time. Yes. I mean, she died in Treblinka on the 12th of September, 1942. But he never came back to Poland. No, he stayed in the Soviet Union. He lived out the rest of his life in the Soviet Union.
There's a story you tell how he sent a Russian limousine to fetch the children. Can you tell us a little bit more around what happened the consequences of it?
Yeah. So look. So my mom and her brothers, they had this incredibly supportive group of friends of my grandmother, medical doctors, who looked after them. They would bring clothes to the orphanage. They would bring them food. They would give them lots of love and attention. They were their guardians, legal guardians. So it wasn't just during the Nazi occupation that these people saved my mom and her brother's lives, but then they continued to show a lot of interest thereafter. And they were determined to prevent them from leaving for the Soviet Union, because obviously as my grandfather was their biological father, he did have rights to demand that they come and join him in the Soviet Union. And at one stage, the story goes that a limousine from the Soviet embassy in Warsaw arrived at the orphanage. Soviet embassy, by the way, is one of the biggest buildings in Warsaw, because Soviets wanted to make the point that, you know, they're really in charge. So sure. It's bigger than the presidential palace.
Wow.
So the Soviet limousine arrived, you know, looking for the kids, with the idea that, you know, they would be bundled into the limousine, they would get their kind of Soviet papers and be put on a plane to go off to the Soviet Union to join my grandfather in this tiny little village in the middle of Russia to live out their lives as Soviet citizens. And the staff, maybe they were forewarned, but the kids kind of were hidden away, and the limousine left without them, and it never happened. So, you know, otherwise, again, my life might have turned out completely different. Well, for one thing, my mom wouldn't have met my father.
So you talked a lot, you said something about British intelligence. So at the moment, you wouldn't really apply that phrase to the present situation in London.
No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. No, definitely not.
So we're just going to take, just going to have a little chat about something else just for a moment, if you don't mind. The Hebrew Order of David does projects around the world. At the moment we are busy with a project called Bringing Yontif Joy, in which we deliver food parcels to those in the community who really need a little bit extra over Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And so we're collecting. We've been asking for donations from the public. We've been emailing the community, and I must say that the generosity of the community is something to behold. But further than that, on the 19th and 20th of September, that's just the week or two before Rosh Hashanah, we're going to be having a collection at the Pick and Pay in Norwood at the Hyper. And if you make a donation, you fill in a form, you're going to a draw, and Pick and Pay have donated a big food parcel with everything that you could possibly want for your table at Yontif. And you stand the chance to win it. The draw will be on Friday, and we will have members of the lodges there to help you and to collect all the stuff that you, doesn't matter how big your donation is. Of course, we'd like the more the merrier, but whatever you can afford and whatever you can give will greatly be appreciated. Last year, a little girl of about 10 or 12 came to us with a packet, and she had emptied out a whole piggy bank. So it brought tears to my eyes, and it's a fantastic gesture. We're not expecting every child to go and empty their piggy banks, but parents, dig deep, and please come and help us. We're talking to Luke Albinski, and we're discussing, he's a Polish Catholic, not as opposed to a Roman Catholic, I guess.
Good man.
And talking about his family, his roots, and his discovery that his family on his mother's side was Jewish, and he still remains a Catholic, but has a certain affinity with the Jews, and as we do with the Catholics. And since the Pope, you know, also wears a yarmulke. And back in the day, and going back to those times, I'm finding in the genealogical sense, more and more people are coming out of the woodwork and saying that they had roots with Jews, and some find that they didn't even know, like you, they didn't know their mother or their father or whatever it was Jewish, and it came out in the discussion later on. And they found, and in fact, there was a lady that came to talk at the HID on one of the nights that we have for the Genealogical Society, and she was the first Jewish person that she thought she was not Jewish, became Jewish, came back, married a Jew, but the wedding took place in Warsaw. It was one of the first weddings in the streets in Warsaw. So it's a fascinating subject. So, Luke, can I just ask you something else, just a surname? So I noticed that some surnames end in an I or an A, so you're Albinski. I see that, I think your mother was Albinska, or?
Yes, so that's simply because females, you just put an A at the end, so you essentially conjugate the surname, whereas males, you put an I.
Is that in general with the...
That's in general, yeah, in Poland, yeah.
Because it's same with people who came from Lithuania, like my surname is Klef, so there was Klefska, and
yeah,
so on. It's quite interesting. I can't quite work it out, but I see conjugation, I understand.
Luke, if I can take you back.
That's the Roman.
amongst your explorations into your family history, you came upon very interesting information about the medical fraternity within the Warsaw Ghetto. One of the things that you noted was that there were 830 doctors.
Yes, no, it's extraordinary. And so there were two functioning hospitals in the ghetto, the Chista Hospital for Infectious Diseases and the Bursin and Bauman Children's Hospital. There were 18 pharmacies. There was research done. Tragically, it was primarily on hunger disease, because almost 100,000 people either starved to death in the ghetto or died of typhus and typhoid. Those are the big causes of death.
So these doctors were qualified in Warsaw, not in Warsaw, I mean in Poland.
Not only. Many had actually qualified abroad in Paris, in Zurich, in Berlin, in St. Petersburg, and of course many in Warsaw.
And a lot were women?
Many were women, and they represented a big portion of Poland's overall core of doctors. So, you know, the proportions were perhaps as much as 25-30% of all doctors in Poland were Jewish.
Can you tell us the story that you once shared, how they started medical studies in the ghetto?
Yes, that's an extraordinary story, and it just shows the incredible resilience of these people, they decided to start a medical university in the ghetto. So can you imagine, amongst all this starvation, amongst all this disease, amongst the horror of daily violence perpetuated by the Nazis and, unfortunately, the Jewish police that were involved. In amongst all of that, a decision was made to start a medical university, and several hundred students got enrolled for first year, and there were a smaller number, maybe 20 or 40 students that got enrolled in second year, because they had already done their first year before the war.
Was there a need? Were they doing this because there was a need for doctors, or was it just a need to give them some sort of education because of what was going on?
You know, they just felt that they had everything they needed in terms of intellectual firepower, because they had some of the most brilliant medical professors and medical specialists that Poland could offer in the ghetto. So they had all the skills. They did it obviously surreptitiously under the noses of the Germans, because that kind of activity was strictly illegal. And the students graduated in kind of June, July 1942, because that was, you know, that was the academic year in Europe where it ends around June, July. And they even, believe it or not, had a graduation dance.
Amazing.
In the ghetto after graduating. And most died a few weeks later, gassed in Treblinka, because the Grossen Aktion, the resettlement of the ghetto, started in July. So a few weeks after graduation, most of those, not only the students, but the doctors, were shipped to Treblinka.
That is a shocking story.
Terrible story. But of the, I think the number's 500 odd, there was, about 100. No, there was 50. There were 50 who registered for further medical studies after the war at Warsaw University. And their courses in the ghetto were considered valid by the Warsaw University after the war.
And they were
accredited. So they were credited with that year they had spent studying in the ghetto. And they were credited with that year also because the results of that first year of study were smuggled out of the ghetto and given to the underground structures that ran the Warsaw University. So that after the war, they could actually compare those records with the students coming in, and they could then credit them for the that year they had done in the ghetto. So there was about 50 Jewish students that registered after the war.
So you presented this at the Limud recently in Johannesburg. And I mean, is this are these stories documented in some form? Is it a well-known thing, or is it just part of your research? Is it something that you've unearthed?
It's quite interesting, because whilst my mom and I were doing research about our family, and we actually employed an amazing Polish researcher who found an incredible treasure trove of documents and photos. This guy's a genius in terms of.
So we actually haven't talked about your mother's role in all of this. So
yes, but in amongst all of this, we came across a Polish Catholic general practitioner in Warsaw called Maria Czeszelska, who off her own bat was doing a lot of personal research around the fate of these doctors in the Warsaw ghetto, had assembled a wonderful book, a 400-page long book about this, and had self-published it, because she couldn't get the support necessary to publish it. So she self-published it. And so she gave me a lot of interesting information, like these stories that you've just heard, and also like some of the final moments of my grandmother's life in the ghetto. And what
she found out about it.
She had collected all the testimonies,
right?
And she had been through all the archives.
Did you go back there to get this, or have you just
yes.
met them?
I've been to Poland many, many times, and my mom lives there, and so what we've done through the Johannesburg Holocaust Genocide Center, with the wonderful support of Tali Nates, is to get this book translated into English, because it's all in Polish, and we're going to publish this book about the doctors of the Warsaw Ghetto.
Or based on the previous book, or is it based on the
Polish book that Maria Czeselska wrote, and that she self-published. Subsequently, it was published, but initially she self-published it. And this was just something she did in her spare time. She was a doctor, you know, a normal doctor in Warsaw, but in her spare time, she spent years of her life researching the fate of Jewish doctors in the ghetto.
And some of the stories that you've unearthed have really been stories of great human spirit, and really kind of managing to find meaning despite the madness of it all.
Correct. It's the phrase is this kind of superhuman medicine, you know, where you're treating people that are destined for death. And so in some ways it's irrational. Why bother anymore? You know, these people are all dying or going to die anyway, but you do it, and you do it right till the end, and then you go with those patients to your own death.
Tell us a little bit about your grandmother, Dr. Helena Rotstein, in terms of, you said she was given opportunity to leave, she chose not to leave, and tell us the rest of her story, what happened.
Yeah, so she was manning the hospital that was on 6 Stawki Street, just by the hospital building that was on 6 Stawki Street, just by the Umschlagplatz, which was the place where the Jews were deported to Treblinka from. And she was pretty much managing that building. She was making sure the people were fed there. She was operating on people that had sustained gunshot wounds in this kind of resettlement process of the ghetto. Again, you wonder, you know, why?
Yeah, to what end?
To what end? Yeah. But it's...
Are these people, like your grandma, are they recognized in Israel, or are they recognized for the work that they've done in some way?
Well,
I mean, they have... Non-Jews would get recognition as being righteous Jews. So righteous non-Jews, but the Jews, were they also, because there's Yaros amongst them?
So it's a good question. I mean, one of the saddest stories is how they set up a little wooden shed on the Umschlagplatz, from which they administered what help they could to the people that were waiting to be deported to their deaths. And when the trains would leave, they would go around picking up babies that had been abandoned by their parents, because that was the parents just felt, well, maybe these babies will have a chance if we just leave them behind on the Umschlagplatz.
And your grandmother would tend to those babies
as best as she could.
Yeah.
But you know, when you're collecting maybe 20, 30 babies, and every day you've got 5 or 10,000 people being deported.
So somewhere in your writing, you talk about the fact that why would somebody undertake this futile operation of when the end was inevitable anyway? Why would they take all this trouble and put all this effort in? That is remarkable.
Yes, but it was the spirit of those doctors. They were so utterly dedicated to their patients and to their profession as doctors. So they were caregivers right till the end.
Amazing. You also went back with your mother to Treblinka, and also you went back with your mother to the hospital. Can you tell us what that was like for you?
Look, it's very moving, and it also exacts a toll on my mom, because she is 83, and you know, for her to go back to these places is a certain trauma. You know, we did, as you know, Natalie, we did the study tour together with Tali, and the one afternoon in the bus, she was crying, and you know, obviously, she was just reliving these terrible times. Mm. So it's traumatic for her.
Did she have a Jewish upbringing in that sense, with a family Jewish or religious?
The family was definitely not Jewish in a religious sense. It was a highly assimilated family, and in fact, one of the testimonies talk about a big Christmas tree in the at the time of Christmas in the apartment in Warsaw. Very wealthy family, and very, very patriotically Polish. So,
and still today.
And still today. My mom is a diehard.
So she went back. When did she go back?
In the 90s.
What drove her? She wanted to go back and live there.
Yes, you know, she still has her three brothers there, and their families. I've got 20 plus cousins in Poland, and lots of friends. And, so she wanted to go back there, and spend her last years in Poland.
So in the family, having had, started off with a 50-50 Jewish Catholic situation. So what's the percentage now? Is it have some of them adopted Judaism, or have they all gone the Catholic route?
Well, so basically there's some that are pretty much atheists. There are some that are Protestants. There are some that are Catholics. Unfortunately, I don't know of any that have gone back to Judaism.
So the Catholics think that Protestants are probably worse than becoming Jewish, and so it's a bit of a family tussle.
But doesn't it speak to the basic humanity and the melting pot of really at the base of it just being humans living through really difficult times?
Yes, and I think for me what it also speaks to, and I think this is important in this day and age where people are, you know, obsessing about singular identities, is this idea that you can have a multiplicity of identities.
Absolutely.
So you can, you know, you can feel proud of your Jewish heritage like I do. You can also, at the same time, feel quite committed to the country of Poland, you know, as a lot of those Jews were, you know, when the ghetto uprising took place in April 1943, They hoisted up the Star of David, of course, but they also hoisted up the Polish flag.
So the motto of this radio station is you don't have to be Jewish. So clearly fits in well with the philosophy.
You talk about flying on the wings of angels, and I mean it's really unbelievably remarkable that all of your mother's siblings went off to get degrees, highly educated, and to really flourish in their lives thereafter.
Yeah, flourish, and even flourish in the context of communist Poland, you know. Yeah. So a great, tremendous resilience, and I think just a awesome gene pool.
Yeah. And a real resistance to Hitler's doctrine. Yeah, to his project, really.
You wrote a book. I'm not sure if you wrote it for publication or you wrote it for the family. You called it the Varsovian Covenant.
I wrote it primarily for my kids. That was really the primary audience. And that was because, you know, I thought to myself when I'm gone one day, you know, I've now got so many great stories, pictures, maps, you know, what have you. This concentration camp cards from my Polish Catholic grandfather. You know, just extraordinary amount of information I've been able to gather. And if I don't kind of somehow collate it and publish it as a book, then it will die with me. So I felt this is something I had to do so that my kids have it, so they can also share it with their kids, maybe their grandkids, and so that this memory doesn't get lost.
Mm. So you called it the Varsovian Covenants. Is that another word for pact? Warsaw Pact, is that a play on words?
Well, you know, so the reason I chose covenant is just because covenant is a promise, but at a very high degree of seriousness. I mean, it's like a covenant with God.
So you said promises honored in the shadows of annihilation.
Yes.
So,
and that's, if you think about it, that's really what it's about, because Halina, my grandmother, she made promises, you know, even the Hippocratic Oath, if you think about it, to her patients, to the people in her care. And she was prepared to go to her death and to stay true to those promises.
So I wonder how many people actually can, or if it can be said about how many people after they've gone, that they honored that. I mean, she really took it to the nth degree.
Took it to the nth degree, but think about the Polish Catholic doctors, members of Zagota. They promised to look after these kids, and they put their families on the line and their own lives on the line to make sure that these kids were safe.
Mm. And what I love about your story is even though it's in the shadow of the darkest part of humanity, but we see the lightest, most hopeful part of humanity. These unbelievable stories of courage, regardless of context and situation.
Absolutely. All my great uncle who fought in the underground army. I mean, he obviously swore an oath of loyalty to the anti-Nazi resistance.
So, we're coming to the end. Unfortunately, when you're in the studio, time seems to fly on the wings of angels. I don't know where it goes, but it's gone. And Luke Albinsky, tell us a little bit about you. Let's start off with the one word that I don't quite get. Is a mezzanine business? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you know what the mezzanine floor of a shopping center is.
Yes.
So that's the floor in, you know, so the ground floor would be senior debt, which would be bank debt. And the first floor would be the equity, the shareholder capital. And we provide this capital in between the two, which is, that's why it's called mezzanine.
Okay. So Luke Albinsky, wife, kids.
Yeah. Sadly recently divorced, but three beautiful kids. Who have each now received the Varsovian Covenants. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of them have read it yet, but I'm hoping they will.
In good time.
marriage appears to be the biggest single cause of divorce. So, business-wise, what do you, just tell us a little bit about your business, how you, what
well,
you're doing.
Well, so we invest all over Africa. We've invested in about 27 deals, many in South Africa. One of our best, recently was a fiber business called Vumatel that you might have heard of because they've kind
yes,
of.
Yes, they're the ones yes. that provide my, wireless.
And are you a happy customer?
Well, up to a point I was. So I have to say that I'm much happy now that you mention it. I've had my issues, but I have to say in your defense, it's really working well.
So that was
and
one.
And by the way, can I have a discount?
So that was one of our investments, but we've also invested in Ghana, in Nigeria. We're just finishing off a deal in Morocco, which is a fascinating place with an absolutely fascinating Jewish history.
We meet you at the Casbah.
Exactly. So yeah, Kenya, Mauritius, Uganda, you name it, we've been there.
So you're not looking for a nice Jewish girl now that you're divorced, is it?
Look,
I think that's where we end the show.
So yes, thank you very much. Thanks for coming in. It's really been a pleasure. I'd really like to hear more about the Doctors of Warsaw. And I think from the genealogical point of view, maybe you would one day come to the Genealogical Society and
give
it a
pleasure,
talk.
Yeah, with pleasure.
And just to end on the last moment to remind everybody, bringing Yontif Joy, 19th and 20th of September, we'll be collecting at the Pick and Pay. There's a big hamper to be given away, and all you have to do is make a donation. We're not prescribing how much you must give, but anything will do. It can be food, it can be just buy something and pop it in the bin or give us thing. There'll be credit card facilities and the like. And I want to thank Natalie for arranging this and for Luke Albinski for coming in here. It's really been a pleasure. And I always forget to thank DJ Flo, the best DJ. I don't know why he's DJ Flo or do we call him DJ, but he's the best person that runs with our show, and it's thanks to him that we're alive. Thank you, good night, and good Shabbos to everyone.